This past Thursday, I drove across the state with my wife to attend a funeral. A husband of one of my wife's friends had been diagnosed with cancer and died very quickly thereafter. We had a funeral here in this room this past week for a dearly loved father and grandfather. It's only been a few months since my grandma died. My wife continues to carry the pain and loss from the death of her father. Over the past year, Pastor Angel has officiated so many funerals that at times I watched it weigh heavy on him. I'm old enough now that people I looked up to as a kid are dying with regularity. If I live long enough, it will be my peers instead. I know death makes us sad, makes me sad, but sometimes lately, it makes me angry too. It steals, it destroys. Death causes loss with seemingly no care for the wreckage left in its wake. The possibility of death always hangs over us and our loved ones. I hate it. I really, really hate it. Do you? Do you know who else hates death? God hates death. But why isn't he putting a stop to it then? Why did my loved one have to die? Why do I or someone I care about have to fight a terrifying disease? If God hates death so much, why doesn't he do something about it? Today, through our time in Acts chapter 9, I'll seek to show that he is doing something about it, even if it doesn't feel like it. God is at war with death. It's a war he already won and that he could finish at any time. God is infinitely stronger than death. It's important to see death as also what leads to it, like disease and injury, the harm that we were never meant to face, but exists because of sin and creation. And also, we need to realize that the core of death is separation. Today, in fairly quick succession, we will see God's war against disease, death, and division. We've been looking at a few individuals as we've worked through Luke's recording of the Acts of the Apostles and others in the early church. We saw Stephen's ministry and his death at the hands and stones of those who disagreed with him about God. We heard about Philip and his outreach. We'll hear about him again eventually. And we heard about Saul, who helped persecute Stephen and then ended up encountering Jesus, which then led to walking in Stephen's footsteps, eventually running afoul of the same people that he once sided with. And Saul, we'll hear about him again a lot. But now Luke pivots away from Saul. Saul had to run away from his hometown, to his hometown of Tarsus to hide until people gave up trying to find and kill him. So now Luke turns his attention to someone we've heard a lot about already in Acts, the Apostle Peter. Now, Peter doesn't get much of a preamble as he's reintroduced here. Luke just expects that we will remember him. So let's pick up as Luke recorded it in Acts chapter 9, verse 32. As Peter traveled about the country, he went to visit the Lord's people who lived in Lydda. So glad I can put these back on the screen again. Peter wasn't doing pastoral house calls here. He was traveling from church to church to check in with them. He might have been teaching and discipling. He might have been correcting and affirming teaching. Luke doesn't tell us specifically about the individual visits to the congregations. Instead, Luke focuses in on what happened in Lydda, about 25 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And he's visiting people Luke recorded as the holy ones, those who could rightly be called the saints. Now, we think of saints usually as the Catholic Church has defined them. Highly regarded, special people who may or may not have been involved in a miracle and who have a special place in their hearts for certain types of people, like Saint Drogo, the patron saint of hairdressers and coffee houses. Those don't seem like they go together to me, but... Saint Homo Bonus, what a name. He's the patron saint of business people and tailors, because apparently tailors aren't business people. And my favorite, Saint Isidore of Seville, patron saint of computer users. So call out to him next time you can't remember that Microsoft Excel shortcut. Now, they may not be the exact saints that you think of when you hear the word, but you get the idea, right? Super special, super spiritual, and apparently super specialized individuals. But do you know who the Bible refers to as saints? Every Christian. The one in spiritual leadership, the one with a prayer ministry, the one is struggling with sin they can't shake, the one constantly wrestling with doubts. Saint is not a title that you achieve. It is a title granted based on Jesus' righteous life, his sacrificial death, and glorious resurrection. Though we are all guilty before God based on our own merit, deserving of eternal punishment for our offenses against our Creator, God loved us too much to allow that to stand. Furthermore, he won the war to regain what was lost. The war is won, yet not completed. We are part of what was lost. So he sent Jesus, fully God, to come as a full, real human being and live the righteousness that we were all created to live. Perfect righteousness, of which we all fell very, very short. And yet he died the death of a guilty person. It's a death that we all deserve. Separation, we all deserve. God, in his just mercy, allows our guilt to go to Jesus and his righteousness to cover us when we believe God. When we call on Jesus as Lord and mean it. Now, if you aren't sure if you've turned and followed Jesus, or if you know that you haven't, you can do so right now in silent prayer. God knows your thoughts. Ask him to forgive you. Admit that your way was wrong. And invite Jesus to be the Lord of your life, your new boss in every aspect. If you truly believe God's way is better, that's exactly what you'll want. Just believing that is enough to find true salvation. And then have God's help to work through the rest. Reach out with a connection card and let us know that you decided to follow Jesus. Or ask some questions. If you prayed and accepted Jesus by faith just now, you are already a saint. Welcome. Now, Peter is in Lydda, and he comes across a guy who finds himself helpless and destitute. Verse 33. Oh, I didn't put that up. There he found a man named Aeneas, who was paralyzed and had been bedridden for 8 years. 8 years. He was not getting better. Aeneas' situation had become hopeless. And how do we know he was also destitute? Well, he couldn't work. He couldn't support himself. He would have required care from others just to survive. We also know from the word used for the type of mat that he laid on, it wasn't luxurious. Society then didn't make many allowances for people with physical struggles. Science and technology didn't offer much help then either. It's worth noting that Aeneas is a Greek name, not a Jewish, not an Aramaic name. So Aeneas was almost certainly either a Jew born and raised outside of Judah, which is my guess, or he was a Gentile, which I think Luke would have noted specifically. Now, in Luke's gospel account, chapter 5, we find Jesus encountered a paralyzed man on a mat. The guy had actually been lowered through a hole in the roof that the guy's friends had made. They tore open the roof. I'm pretty sure that's not covered by Allstate. Jesus told him to get up, take his mat with him. And the guy did. He'd been paralyzed, and Jesus healed him. Jesus was at war with disease and injury, which was demonstrated by this healing. This shows what kind of war this is. Jesus can heal whenever he wants to. This is utterly one-sided. Jesus didn't just manage to get the upper hand here. He is the upper hand. Paralyzed is not the way it's supposed to be. It still isn't. And Jesus wanted us to know that he wasn't going to leave it that way. But by Acts 9, Jesus isn't walking around on earth anymore. Yes, he's alive, but in heaven at the Father's right hand. So now what? Is the war over? On pause? Verse 34. Aeneas, Peter said to him, Jesus Christ heals you. Get up and roll up your mat. Peter gives the same command, but he's quite clear. This is not something Peter is attempting to do. Peter is claiming that Jesus is healing this hopeless, helpless, and destitute, paralyzed man. That's a huge statement to make. But notice what Peter doesn't do. He isn't making a spectacle of this situation. If this healing works, people will find out because the community was small enough and tight-knit enough that word was going to get around that Aeneas was up and walking. But Peter doesn't use any of the theatrics that are often found in supposed faith healer shows. More importantly, does this work? Finishing verse 34. Immediately, Aeneas got up. It worked. Aeneas was healed. A hopeless situation changed by the power of God. Here's what Luke wants you to know. God's fight against disease and injury continues through the church. Jesus won the decisive victory at the cross and the resurrection, and now the church enforces that victory, demonstrating his power over sickness and death. It wasn't just a thing Jesus did. And that's important because if it was only something done during Jesus' earthly ministry, we might see it as just signs that he did in order to get people to believe him. But it was more than that. God was actually defeating disease. Jesus, Peter, and Luke all want us to know that God continues pushing back his already defeated enemies through his church. The victory was won at the cross and the resurrection, but it won't be completed until Jesus returns. But it will be completed. In the American Civil War, after the Confederacy was crushed and Lee surrendered to Grant, there were still skirmishes and battles, even though the war was already decided. World War II had similar incidents. One side was defeated, but was clutching, trying to hold on to something, anything. Death is holding on to what it can. But this is all fighting after the deciding blow has been struck. Now, let me be clear about what this means for us in regards to sickness and disease, because we've already talked about what it means for our hopelessness in our guilt before God. The cross struck the decisive blow there. We were hopeless, more hopeless than Aeneas. And he gave us salvation, freedom. Let us join him in his victory. But it doesn't just speak to that. He's not just saving souls. He's concerned about our bodies. So what does this mean? Miraculous healings like this were not common even in Acts. Luke records these specific incidents because they were remarkable, not because they were routine. The church enforces Jesus' victory over disease primarily through compassionate care, medical science, prayer, and presence with the suffering, not through claiming that we can heal on demand. Peter himself doesn't seem to have gone around healing everyone that he met. These unique miracles demonstrated Christ's authority and pointed people to him. We join this war through faithful service in healthcare, through praying for the sick, through caring for bodies and souls, trusting that Jesus will complete healing in his time, whether now or in the resurrection. But there's a question. Whenever we cover a text like this, that I assume that some are asking, why not me? Or its close cousin, why not my loved one? Why did God heal Aeneas, but you struggle still with some sort of physical issue or scary disease? Why isn't God doing something about it? And if you are a Christian, the simple answer is he did. He did do something about it. Now, if you're given tickets to a Lions game that takes place in mid-December, you don't say, why can't I go to the Lions game? You recognize that when the time comes, you will get to go. Occasionally, people like Aeneas get healed in immediate fashion. But realize that even Jesus didn't heal every sick or injured person he encountered. At the Pool of Bethesda, as recorded in John 5, Jesus heals a paralyzed man who was also laying on a mat. Jesus told him to pick up the mat and go. The Pool of Bethesda was a place that diseased and injured people congregated. But Jesus slipped away in the crowd after healing only one person. And in the scope of sick and dying people, healings were always rare. Healing was demonstrating God's power over disease, over already defeated death, and it was teaching. Yes, it was a kind and wonderful thing to do, but it was also done with a purpose. But the point is, if you are a Christian, one day you will experience life without that disease or injury. If not in this life, then guaranteed on the new earth. And you'll never have to worry about getting sick or hurt ever again, because not the way it's supposed to be will give way to God's completed victory in the war, and it will be as it's supposed to be always and forever. These healings that we read about in the Bible are just a temporary taste of what is to come, and that's how we're supposed to see them, not as a normal expectation for every Christian in this life. Peter said, Jesus Christ heals you, or it could be translated, Jesus Christ is healing you. Jesus is still at work. He's still enforcing his victory, pushing back his defeated enemies. We should be too. The church continues Jesus' ministry, caring for people, standing against disease, death, and division. We probably have some pharmacists, paramedics, doctors, and nurses, and others who work in healthcare here today. Your work can be a ministry if you do it for God's glory. Someone working in health insurance can work for God's glory if you're truly doing your best to get people help fairly. In fact, anytime you bandage a wound, pick up medicine for someone, or help accommodate someone with a physical limitation, you join in the fight against disease. We can join Jesus in his war against disease and injury, but he will deal the final blow himself. And in fact, he's already dealt the decisive one. Now, Peter didn't do this as a stage show, but like we mentioned, this was bound to get noticed. Verse 35. All those who lived in Lydda and Sharon saw him and turned to the Lord. Now, remember that Luke likes to use all hyperbolically. It's just part of his style, I guess. But still, this got noticed, and people, many people, believed. They wanted to side with this Jesus who was at war with something that was seeking to destroy them. As this was going on in Lydda, something else was happening in Joppa, about 12 miles northwest of Lydda on the Mediterranean coast. Verse 36. In Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha. In Greek, her name is Dorcas. She was always doing good and helping the poor. In Greek, her name was Dorcas, so we're going to go ahead and make the choice to use her Aramaic Jewish name. But if you know a Tabitha, now you've got a fun nickname for her. Now, both names actually mean gazelle, which is nice. It sounds graceful. In fact, Luke describes Tabitha as being quite graceful. She offered grace, acts of kindness as a regular part of her life. Luke tells us she helped the poor, and as we will see, she had a particular focus on widows. In that day and age, a widow could become very vulnerable very quickly after her husband died. Men were almost always the primary or exclusive provider for the household. While Jewish law provided for women via inheritance, in practice, this was rarely carried out if there was a male heir. Therefore, widows were often reliant on children to support them. Sometimes they didn't have children, or those children couldn't support their mother for some reason, and some even refused to. Because they were dependent on outside help, widows could often be taken advantage of in cruel ways. And even if many didn't get actively taken advantage of, most just faded into the background of society. Unseen, unknown. But Tabitha saw them. She was kind. We will see she handmade clothing items that those widows desperately needed, but they never could have afforded. She was a special lady doing important work, caring for some of the most vulnerable people in society. While Peter is healing Aeneas and Lydda, this happens. Verse 37. About that time, she became sick and died. And her body was washed and placed in an upstairs room. This describes a sickness that came on suddenly, hit hard, and killed quickly. This is just awful. Such a wonderful, sweet woman, and this has to happen? It's just not right. If someone has close to you has died, and you've been left feeling that this isn't right, you are absolutely correct. Death is an invader. It doesn't belong in creation. Death is not the way it's supposed to be. And yet, everyone dies. Until Jesus returns, there is no escaping this death that Tabitha experienced. But it isn't right. And it's exactly how you should feel when someone that you care about dies. It's an attack from the enemy. Even though we know that God has done and will do something about it, it's good and right to hate death. It's a terrible villain, an evil monstrosity. Now, Luke tells us how Tabitha's body was washed, which was normal burial prep. And then she was put in an upstairs room, which is not normal burial prep. You normally found a cool place to keep the body, not a warm upstairs room, and you buried the body within 24 hours. Luke doesn't explain their reasoning, but it has something to do with Peter being nearby, because we see this in verse 38. Lydda was near Joppa, so when the disciples heard that Peter was in Lydda, they sent two men to him and urged him, "Please come at once." This was about a 3 to 4 hour walk. If Peter did respond quickly, it might have even been within that 24-hour window before a burial or entombment would normally have taken place. We aren't told what was expected of Peter. Maybe they wanted him to do something at Tabitha's funeral. Maybe they heard about Aeneas or previous incidents like the healing involving Peter and John in Acts chapter 3. Maybe they were just grieving and wanted help understanding and thought the Apostle Peter could help. Regardless, when he arrives, it's a scene that I find truly heartbreaking. Verse 39. Peter went with them, and when he arrived, he was taken upstairs to the room. All the widows stood around him, crying and showing him the robes and other clothing that Dorcas had made while she was still with them. I have a few blankets and ceramic items that my grandma made for me. When I encounter those or use those, I often think of my grandma and how much she loved me. But this is even more than that. These widows, remember, were unseen by society. They were shuffled off out of the way, maybe helped sometimes, maybe not, and to most people it just didn't matter because they didn't notice. These widows were showing Peter precious gifts that showed that Tabitha really saw them. She took time to get to know them. She knew their sizes, their names, their needs. She spent her time on them. And now she's dead. And all the widows can do is clutch her last gifts and cry. Jesus raised a few dead people, including a 12-year-old girl. Luke tells about it in Luke chapter 8. It's part of showing that Jesus is at war with death and that death doesn't stand a chance. Mark tells us this account too in Mark chapter 5. And there, Mark tells us that Jesus put everyone out of the room, leaving him and the girl's parents and his closest disciples alone with the dead girl. Back to Acts 9, verse 40. Peter sent them all out of the room. Then he got down on his knees and prayed. In Mark 5, Jesus called the girl Talitha, which means little girl. He said, "Talitha, get up." Back to Acts 9, verse 40. Turning toward the dead woman, he said, "Tabitha, get up." Not only is Jesus continuing to enforce his victory over disease, so too his victory over death itself carries on through the church. Peter is following Jesus' example in really blatant ways, clearly carrying on what he saw take place with Talitha, the little girl. That little girl came back to life at Jesus' words. Finishing verse 40. She opened her eyes, and seeing Peter, she sat up. He took her by the hand and helped her to her feet. Then he called for the believers, especially the widows, and presented her to them alive. I love that Peter put that special focus on the widows. Tabitha had seen them, cared about them, and Peter did too. In all this, Peter didn't presume upon God. He didn't even assume that he knew what God wanted to do. Before even turning to Tabitha's dead body, he dropped to his knees in prayer, presumably seeking God's direction. And he again didn't make a spectacle of this. It is Jesus' war, not Peter's show. Now, some of you might be wrestling with that same question from earlier. Why not my loved one? If God can bring people back from the dead, why not them? Let me remind you of a few things, even as I admit that I don't know why God didn't do that in your specific case. First, Tabitha is dead. Yes, Jesus used Peter to raise her from the dead, but she died again. In fact, Peter died too. So did Saul, Paul, Philip, James. All these people died. So God didn't keep raising them or keep them alive in perpetuity in this life. Death comes for us all. That's how it works right now. That's the war that we are in. That's the battle that we each lose eventually. And thankfully, none of those battles decide the war. Second, death is terrible, but God didn't exempt himself from it. God the Father knows what it is like to have a child die. Jesus knows what it is like to experience the worst kind of death, brutal and awful. And he didn't just face it along with us, he faced it for us. Because third, God may not have raised our loved ones from the dead now, but he's playing the long game. So we need to keep the long view. Through Jesus, he did what was necessary to raise every Christian from the dead to meet Jesus in the air when he returns to complete the victory over disease and death. You may not have today with that Christian loved one who died, but you will have a day with them. And another, and another, and another. And no death will ever take them away again. We join God in this war too. We talked about medical professionals, but also if you're a police officer, a firefighter, even working security here at the church, you're combating death even just through vigilance. In fact, when you go to the gym, not our gym where we're going to eat a whole bunch of food, I'm talking about to work out. When you go to the gym, when you eat a healthy diet, when you help encourage others to do the same, you join in this fight against death. When Jesus raised that little girl from the dead, word spread all throughout the region. Matthew tells us in his account. And that was despite Jesus telling people to keep it quiet. It still spread. Verse 42. This became known all over Joppa, and many people believed in the Lord. Many people believed in who? Yeah, not Peter. In Jesus, the Lord. A church, a ministry, it should never be about any person but Jesus. Too often, groups can get excited about the charisma and skill of a particular servant, but while we can and should appreciate them and their efforts, it all needs to drive us to love, obedience, and honor for Jesus. When we make a big deal about any other person, we are going to be disappointed, either when they fall short in some way or when they die. Now, we have one more verse, and I'll be honest, I saw it as transitionary when I first read it, almost a throwaway line, and I really should have known better. Luke doesn't waste words. And even these seemingly innocuous words are in fact the word of God. Verse 43. Peter stayed in Joppa for some time with a tanner named Simon. Again, in my initial read through, I read this and I thought, okay, cool. I did note that Peter's name is actually Simon, changed to Peter by Jesus. So there's that, Simon and Simon. That's an old show. But I missed the cultural piece until I studied. A tanner works with dead things. As such, according to Jewish law, a tanner was perpetually considered unclean. Now, don't anybody mention being perpetually unclean to Danny Tanner. But on a practical, another old show. On a practical note, because of the materials that a tanner used, they always stunk. They smelled bad all the time. This all served to make them social outcasts. They were avoided when they couldn't be ignored. And maybe you can think of people like that. Maybe you've even felt like that yourself. Society likes to divide and not in ways that treats people like equals. Watch Fox News and you'll experience division, and those Democrats are fools or evil. If you watch MSNBC, you'll experience division. And those Republicans are idiots or fascists. When you went to school as a kid, you experienced divisions. Some were just considered better than others. Others have experienced this kind of belittling because of their race, their gender, or maybe like Simon, because of their job. Now, we certainly hope that that division isn't imposed for those reasons by societies. We want to work against that where we see it. But individuals and groups can easily target people they decide are different from them in ways that makes those that they divide lesser. Right here in this one seemingly passing verse, we see that this mindset has no place among God's people. The people who choose not to follow Jesus or who ignore Jesus entirely are divided from us, yes, but by their choice. No matter their background, struggle, or even how they feel about us right now, we want them to know Jesus and experience his salvation. We want that division eliminated. In the church, we have different roles, but not different value. We are a people, not a divided gathering. And that's one reason I am incredibly grateful for and deeply love our language ministry here. Whether it's teaching ESL or even Spanish as a second language last year, or the amazing work our live translators do into Spanish, we are making it clear that we don't want language to be a barrier either. We don't want culture to be a barrier. In fact, it highlights the beauty of how God brings us together. He doesn't wipe out our cultural differences. He beautifies them. I look forward to when we finish getting our songs in Spanish too, so that we can have both English and Spanish words on the screen, and we can sing our hearts out next to each other, celebrating the same truth, even with totally different words. God brings out the different experiences, backgrounds, cultural elements, and even foods for us to enjoy together, to strengthen each other, to create a kaleidoscope of beauty for his glory. And now I want taquitos. One more reason, as if you didn't already have enough, to stay for lunch to hear from the missionaries, right? Well, in fact, that division goes away too. Just because we live in different areas, whether across the state or across the world, we have the most important things in common. And so when we encounter each other, we are brothers and sisters, even if we have never met. I look forward to hearing what God has been doing through a cool puppet ministry and in exciting work in India. God is at war against division. And we can join him in it. We should. Learn another language. Experience someone else's culture. Take time to listen, to really listen, and to get to know someone else. Give them your time like Tabitha did for the widows. Our war is not against people, even if they disagree with us. Even if they vote differently than us. Our war is enforcing Jesus' already won victory against lies, disease, injury, death, division, and dehumanizing. And it's been woven throughout what we've talked about today. But just to be really, really clear, if you want to join the war, the already won war, but not yet completed war, against disease, death, and division, share and live the gospel. Share and live the gospel. Because you may not be able to heal someone's malady. None of us can raise them from the dead. And we can work against division, but let's face it is rampant. If you want to join the war in a meaningful way, share and live the gospel. Because that is what God is using to run over disease, to overthrow death, and to knock down every wall between us. What can you do? You can invite somebody to church. You can share the gospel with them. You can show them what a Christian lives like, not angry and divided, not finding ways to assume the worst about them, by being kind, being friendly, and telling the truth in love. Let's join God in his war. How can you do that this week, joining and enforcing his victory? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have defeated disease, death, division. You've defeated sin, guilt, and shame. Thank you that at the cross, by experiencing the worst of it, you pulled us out of it. Thank you that by faith, by believing you, we can be granted your righteousness. Thank you that even though if you don't return sooner, each one of us will die, and yet that won't be the end. For every person who belongs to you by faith, it's not the end of joy. It's not the end of togetherness. We thank you that we have eternity with you, eternity with each other, and not as it is now, but as it was meant to be. We pray that you will help us live in light of that, invite others into it, and carry on this ongoing victory that you are rolling out into people's lives. May you bless our efforts and guide them. Amen. If you want to talk with an elder about a struggle you're having, or if you're interested in baptism or joining Mayfair on mission through membership, use the connection card to let us know. We are called to be part of Jesus' war against disease, death, and division. We can play real, meaningful roles, but it's his war. He started it, he will finish it. Even for our parts now, we need his help, his direction, his power. Let's acknowledge our need together. Stand if you're able.